This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
My name's Beatrice, but everybody calls me Trixie.
That's a hooker's name.
What's a hooker?
Ask your mother.
Our guest today is the Prince of Darkness himself. But before he became a huge star off the back of Netflix's smash hit Lucifer, he worked his way up from drama school with bit parts until his breakthrough in British TV favourite Miranda. We chat about why his new movie Players is bringing back the classic rom-com, how he accidentally fell into acting, and his most embarrassing moment involving George Clooney and a pair of Ugg boots. Our guest today is actor Tom Ellis.
Can you hear me?
I can. I can hear you. I can see you.
I've got you, Elliot. I've got you.
How's it going, Tom? How's your day?
Good, thanks, mate. Just starting. Got up with my very young baby this morning and now talking to you.
You're like, oh, why? I'll make it as painless as possible, I promise.
No, it's good.
Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it, man. You know, obviously you're doing very well for yourself and you've got to this point where, you know, you're doing great projects, but how did that start? Where did that kind of passion for performance come from?
It crept up on me actually when I was at school. I for the most of my schooling years in the UK, I didn't do drama. I did a lot of music because my mum was a music teacher and we all were lumbered with instruments when we were young kids. And so like going through school, it was music or sport actually were my two like main things. And I thought that I would probably end up doing something to do with sport. And then I was doing my A-levels, and very early on in my A-levels, one of them, I was doing history and I wasn't particularly enjoying it. So I decided to, drop that subject. And then my sixth form tutors were like, well, you need to do another subject. You need a third A-level. And I really didn't have a clue what to do. And then my old English teacher, who I'd done my GCSEs with, had heard this news that I was looking for a new subject. And she came and found me and said, I'm running the theatre studies course. I've got 12 girls and I've got one boy. I need boys. Are you interested? And I was like, I'm going to stop you right there. How many girls? And it was completely the wrong motivation to go and join a class. But I started going to these theatre studies classes and everything just felt right. I was like, oh my God, I feel like this is what I should be doing. I really enjoy it. And I was getting really positive feedback from the teachers. And then it kind of just snowballed really quickly from there. I got cast in the school play. After I did that, a friend of mine's mum, who was an actress, called me up and said, I saw you in the school play and I really think you should think about doing this. Wow. And so her and my drama teacher conspired to talk to my parents and convinced them that I should go and audition for drama school. And I did, and I got a place at the Royal Scottish Academy, and I went straight there at 18. And it weirdly, Elliot, it's been quite sort of, since I sort of stumbled across it, it's been kind of seamless. And, you know, for me, that's just sort of, just suggests that maybe I did find the right thing.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Slow sort of growth from there, basically.
Yeah. Great to have as well those people around you that kind of champion you and obviously propelled you forward at that point as well. With school and teachers, that you don't really know it at the time, but you look back and you think, God, that was one little decision, and it kind of
completely. And I'm still in touch with Claire, my old drama teacher. We catch up every time I'm back in Sheffield, and I mean, she is a huge part of my life and how my life has kind of shaped. And I'll never forget that, really, especially with a subject like drama, because people are always like, oh, are you sure? Don't you want to do something like real or proper?
Yeah.
You know, guarantee that you'll get something. And, you know, everyone talks to you about how competitive it is and all of those things. But I think, you know, installing some kind of belief that you have a unique quality different to everybody else, that's the thing that she really helped me believe, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. When you first declare to the world that you want to be an actor, everyone's kind of like, you don't want to earn money? Is that what it is? Like, you don't want a job? I remember pretending to be on my gap year for the first 2 or 3 years. But did you ever have, was there another kind of profession that you you thought, well, I might be a, I don't know, a lawyer, or I might be a bus driver, or was there something else before you committed to the acting?
Well, I think you know, going back to the sports, I mean, I'm still obsessed with sport. I absolutely, it's a big part of my life. But I played a lot of sports, but I was aware quite early that I was not good enough to kind of pursue them professionally. That being said, I still wanted the glory of running on the pitch. So I decided I wanted to go into physiotherapy and like just the guy with the magic sponge that runs on. So I kind of like targeted that, and sports science and physio and sports recovery, injury recovery and stuff like that was definitely, you know, something I was really interested in. And, you know, I still am now. But it wasn't what I felt was my calling, I suppose. But I could easily, you know, see myself having done that in a sort of sliding doors moment for sure.
Was there a moment where, you know, getting your first agent, first audition, do you remember those kind of first few steps and how terrifying they were? If they were terrifying, maybe.
Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was so I studied at a place called the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, which is in Glasgow. And at the end of, halfway through your third year there, which is your final year, they do a showcase for agents and casting directors and producers. Now, because we were in Glasgow, lots of people were not willing to travel. So they actually took us, we showcased in Glasgow, and then we went down to London for 2 days, and we did a showcase at the Criterion Theatre and Piccadilly Circus. And there was a tradition there at that moment in time. This is in the year 2000, bloody hell, which is like nearly 25 years ago.
When you say it like that, Jesus.
I know, it's so weird.
Weird how it's that long
really
ago.
Advanced at the time. We were the class of 2000. I was like, look at us. After the showcase, so they do it on a lunchtime, right? And after the showcase finishes, there was a tradition that we would all go to this pub around the corner, and the years before had all done this as well. And then we all sort of spent the afternoon drinking together and talking about what had happened. But there'd been a brochure when we were doing the showcase that had all our phone numbers in it. And so people's phones started, and everyone had just started to get mobile phones. People's phones started to ring. And it was agents or casting directors saying that they'd seen us in this thing, and would I be willing to come in and meet and have a chat about representation? And it was all incredibly exciting, but it was also really brutal because these 30 people that we'd, you know, spent our last 3 years with, it all seemed to hinge on this one moment. And some people's phones rang a lot, and some people's phones didn't ring at all. And it was kind of stark and horrible, and you know, you're quietly happy with what's happening for you if it's working out, succeeding, whilst at the same time feeling completely awful for your friend who's sitting in the corner whose phone hasn't rung. And it was horrible, but I was one of the fortunate people, and I had a couple of agents call me, and I went to go and meet them, and that was it. I basically got representation straight from that and started to audition whilst I was still at drama school. So I'd come down on the sleeper train from Glasgow to London, and have £10 in my pocket, two embassy number ones, and basically I just would walk around London until it was time to go to my audition, and then get back on the train and go back to college. And that sort of happened for the first couple of months, and then I got a job, which was incredibly exciting. It was The Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby for ITV. It was like a two-part drama, and I got a small part in that, and I got to leave college early and go and do it. And then basically jobs just kept sort of coming in, and I would move on to the next job. And I very rarely had any time that I wasn't doing anything.
That's amazing.
And I felt like I felt like my ambitions when I was at drama school was I just want to go out and work. And I was fulfilling my ambition, really. But you're sort of, ambitions change as things get fulfilled. So it was everything I hoped it would be. I just was one of the fortunate ones. That's how I view it.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's incredible. And I mean, obviously, you say obviously you've had a lot of luck and you've been working continually. During the course of your career, have you had any sort of substantial downtime where you've had to kind of think, oh, is this it? Or has there ever been a kind of a moment when you thought, oh my God, maybe it's all going to go away? Is it, is there that fear, or it, you just,
Oh, I think
you've just been really
that
lucky?
fear lives. That's a healthy fear that every actor has. Where am I going to ever work again? No matter how successful you are. But there was a very sort of humbling moment, I'd say, probably about 18 months, 2 years into leaving drama school. And I've been working, 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 and it was great. And then I got cast in a thing on the BBC with Ricky Tomlinson. And it was like the biggest part I got, and it was amazing. And I was like, wow, this is just like happening like a dream. I didn't think it would ever be like this. And I went away and shot that. And then I didn't work again for probably like 6 months. And that was when it was like, oh, okay, there's a reality here. There's a, you know, and you've never made it. You've never kind of like, it's not that simple. And I ended up having to go and work for my mum, actually. My mum ran a doctor's practice in Bristol, and I ended up being a receptionist there for a few months. And then like going to audition for Casualty or Holby City or something like that. It was really random. But that was the biggest kind of dearth of, like, you know, the biggest chunk of time that I've had where I hadn't been working as an actor. But I think it was probably the best thing that happened to me as well, because it sort of hyper-focused me and made me realise that I need to work a lot harder. I'm intrinsically quite a lazy person. And I think that, you know, learning to take it seriously as a profession, realising that, you know, your livelihood depends on this, and you're not the only person desperate to get this job. So I sort of came to the conclusion that I needed to work as hard as possible on every audition that I got, and leave no stone unturned, just so I knew that if I came out of that room, I could never say, God, I wish I'd worked a bit harder. I wish I'd done this, or I wish I'd done that. Knowing that I'd gone into a room and done everything I possibly could to get the job, and if it didn't work out, I'd sort of was philosophical about it, because I was like, well, I know that I worked really hard. And a lot of time, you know, decisions are out of your hands. It's something that you could be too tall for a job. I've missed out on jobs because I'm too tall compared to the actor who's already cast, or, you know, or too, I look too old for my age, or whatever. It's silly things. My hair color, it's, you know, I should be blonde. It's stuff like that. And you get, the longer you do it, the more understanding you have of that process. And so it's just about taking control of the factors that you can take control of.
Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm, where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at Life and Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge Life and Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times. And I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show. In terms of auditioning and stuff like that, do you have a certain thing that you do? Do you have any sort of preparation, keys of preparation that you would kind of pass down to other actors? Do you have any sort of ritual for going in the room that helps you? I mean, we've had some guests on here that have, they do all kinds of strange things before they go into an audition, and it's just funny. I mean, sometimes the wildest things. But I wondered if you, depending on the role, do you have anything that you kind of do prep wise?
It's a tough one. I always try to be off book. Just so I can free myself up. And sometimes that is like, feels like a ludicrous thing. Like, especially with, it used to be, it's not quite the same anymore, but it used to be if you got a call about like doing an audition for something in the States, more often than not, you get a call the night before and they're like, they want you to come in tomorrow. There's 13 pages to look at and they want you off book. And it'd be like, that's just bonkers. How am I going to do that? But it's weird when you really apply yourself, how much you can do. And how much you can train your brain to do those sort of things. So that's one thing that I would do. But I think more importantly, it was learning to make choices, like, you know, choices about performance, choices about character and stuff like that. I think a lot of the time you get sent what they call casting breakdowns. This character is this. They're a lot like this character in this other show and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And if you read those things, it can really pollute your process, because you're spending so much time trying to mimic or be like something else as opposed to seeing what it is and taking it in and then authentically applying what you have to it and authentically making your choices about it. Now, there might not be the same choices as what the producer or director is looking for, but at least you've made some clear choices. Mm-hmm. I think if you go in and you're trying to just please people, what do you want from me? I think that you're setting yourself up for failure, basically.
That's interesting. So do you normally avoid looking at what they've said about the breakdown and what the character is and read the script first, get your interpretation, and then maybe have a look and see what they've said and see if it lines up?
For sure. I try to. But I also think, you know, and this comes with experience as well, you know, a lot of these casting breakdowns are not written by the writer of the script. They're written by, you know, someone in the casting office who's trying to sort of bullet point and be helpful. But sometimes it has the adverse effect. And so I think going to the, like you would do with a play, you go to a play and you open it up and you read it. And then it informs you whilst you're reading it. And you have these kind of, you know, your instincts take you to certain places. And I think trusting your instinct and making choices based on that is a really important thing. If you go back and it's like, oh, that's completely different to what they're suggesting here, fair enough. Maybe think about why they're suggesting other things. But I think it's really important that you take matters into your own hands a little bit, because essentially they're going to get you at the end of the day. That's what, again, going back to that thing of understanding that every performer has their own unique thing, and it doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong, but it's certainly your strongest hand in the game of cards that we're playing. So I think trusting that is the hardest thing to do as well when you're dealing with rejection all the time. But it is super important.
Starting out your career, going to drama school and working your way up, doing these bit parts. And I mean, the list of things that you've been in as well, it literally is, you've got some of the most quintessential British shows on TV. I mean, you've got a brilliant list of credits. But was there a moment where, and I mean, looking at the list, I can guess, but was there a kind of job that kind of changed everything? Was there a moment when you went, oh, wow, this is suddenly a massive part and this is going to, this is going to give me a chance to really showcase?
For sure. I'd say there was like two moments. There was one in the UK and then there was one over here in the States. The UK one was, I'd never really been involved in something from the start that had gone on to be successful. And in the UK, when Miranda came along, you know, no one knew really, apart from inside the business, who Miranda Hart was. And I read this script and it was bonkers. I mean, it was literally bonkers, and I didn't know what to make of it because I hadn't met Miranda at this point. I didn't really know about her delivery. I didn't really know about, you know, her sense of humor. But there was something there. And then I went to the audition and she was at the audition and I read with her and everything just suddenly clicked. And I was like, oh my God, this is genius. This woman is hilarious. And I really want to do this job. Thankfully she cast me in it. And being involved in something like that where you're really enjoying it and thinking it's really funny is one thing. But when the first season came out and got the reaction that it did, It was like, oh wow. And then the second season came along really quickly, and then, you know, Miranda won comedy awards, and it suddenly had become this thing that people knew about and people were gravitating towards, and that felt amazing. And it gave me a lot of confidence about where I was, you know, in life, and that I was doing something great. And and then that sort of helped my push towards starting to come to the States to audition over here for pilot season, which is at the beginning of every year. It's changed a lot now with streaming, but all the TV networks used to be making pilots for their next year of programming. And it was like a festival of auditioning. I mean, people would come here and it's just, you'd get like 4 or 5 auditions a day. It was bonkers. But again, dealing with a huge amount of rejection. But I did that for a few years and I got a few pilots, and they didn't, you know, they never got picked up. And then this job came in called Rush. And I remember reading it the first time. I feel like I'd been waiting for this part to come along. And I knew what my strengths were, and I knew, you know, what I was sort of gravitating towards them. And this script came in and I was like, oh shit, this is it. This is the one. And I was in the UK, I was doing a play at the Menier Chocolate Factory, and they asked me to make a tape. So I made a tape, and I had this weird feeling when I was making it. I was like, if I do a good job on this, I think I'm going to get it. And I made the tape, and within 24 hours, I got a call from the director, Jonathan Levine, who said, I've seen your tape and I really want you to do this. I was like, what?
Wow.
And it was a big lead role. It was the name of the show. It was a great character. It was everything I'd been looking for. And it basically opened up the world for me over here. Mm-hmm. And I came out, did it. We did one season of it. It was cancelled. But again, I'd already had this philosophy of, I'm just going to throw myself into this. I'm going to apply myself to it. And I'm never going to walk away from this thinking, oh, I wish I'd done that, or wish I'd done that. Mm-hmm. And it just set everything up, basically.
This is an emergency.
This is probably going to hurt.
Okay. She was saying all this crazy stuff.
We should need to get to a hospital.
You know the policy. We don't scream, we don't discriminate, we don't judge. We treat people who pay.
I got it.
Good.
Rush the series.
So, I got a call from the director, and I came out, I did it and had an amazing time doing it. And then it didn't work out in terms of doing more seasons of it, but what it did do was introduce me to people at the studios over here as someone who could lead a show. Then it wasn't long after Rush was cancelled that the script for Lucifer came in. And again, it was one of those things where I had this feeling of, I think I could do a really good job with this. I just need to make, and I made some really bold choices on it. And I went and met Len Wiseman, who was directing it, and the rest is history, basically. It was just one of those things. But it didn't just happen overnight. You know, coming out here didn't happen overnight at all. I came out here for the first time in 2009 and did a pilot. Then Miranda happened. And I think it was 2013, something like that, that I then came out again. And then it just started to snowball after that, basically.
Well, just to go back to Lucifer, because now I'm a fanboy, that part and that the script and everything about it is just, it must have been so much fun to play. I mean, how often do you get to play a part like that? It's not a mainstream run-of-the-mill role, is it?
Well, no, not at all. And I realized that as well when I got it. I was like, there is so much that you can do with this. And as the series kind of evolved, you know, going to work on that was so much fun because I was doing something completely different every day. There was moments of ridiculous comedy, moments of intense drama, moments of big action sequences, you know, moments of music and singing. And it was such a gift. And I loved every minute of it. I really did.
What was it like for that to then come to, I mean, obviously I know you did other jobs as well as when you were doing Lucifer, but what was it like when that moment in your life kind of came to an end and you were like, oh, well, that's that then? Was that kind of a strange feeling to leave that character behind?
I think, yeah, it was. I mean, I was really ready to finish by the end because it had been a long, you know, we've been doing it for 6, 7 years, something like that. And I, you know, I was ready to move on and play a different character. But it was weird. I mean, actually, it was the set of players that was my first job after Lucifer.
Oh, wow, really?
And I remember being riddled with like insecurity about, oh my God, I just don't want to be like that.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
I want to stop. And, you know, playing someone for 6 years, it's really difficult not to, you know, it just happens, if you know what I mean. You don't think of it. So it was more of like I was policing myself, trying to be not like Lucifer. And, you know, it took a few days on set to kind of really feel like, okay, I've shed that now. I can just sort of be. But yeah, it was a strange experience for sure.
That must be, yeah, it must be mad. And it's kind of like, you know, when you see anyone from Friends in something else, you're going, well, they're kind of being Chandler in that, or they're kind of being, do you know, it's that kind of thing where people expect you to be that character no matter what the show or the film is. But having watched your movie and then watched Lucifer, I can tell you there's a massive difference between those two characters. That's the hard thing, though, isn't it? If you're so used to seeing someone playing a certain role, you kind of almost want them to be that. And that's mad to think, because am I right in thinking that Lucifer finished in 2021?
Yeah.
But I guess we've had the pandemic. There's been all kinds of, you know, strikes in the industry and everything else. Was that a time where you kind of a bit weird, where you kind of, you know, in between work? I mean, maybe you weren't, maybe you were still working, but it felt like it was a bit of a hole in the industry at the time.
It was really strange. I mean, we were at that moment in time, we were shooting what we thought was going to be the last season of Lucifer. And then, you know, it was weird watching just the world was closing down, and you could feel it closing in, this pandemic. And it's like, we're going to get shut down any day. And then we did. And then, you know, we waited. We were one of the first shows to go back. I remember that, back to the Warner Brothers lot. And it was crazy. And I never, ever want to do anything like that again. I mean, to wear a face mask and a face shield and protective clothing, you know, during rehearsals and any time that you're literally not on camera. And it was horrible. And I understood why we were doing it, but it was creatively not a very nice experience. And, you know, compared it to, at all this time doing this show, not like that, and then having to do it like that, felt so unfulfilling in many ways. But then when we came back, Netflix had already decided that they wanted to do another season because it had been going so well. So we went back, literally finished season 5 and went straight into season 6. And I think by that point, I felt like I was nearly at the end of a marathon just when the pandemic hit. And then it was like, what? There's another marathon? Okay. But I, you know, it was testament to how popular it had become. And I don't think Netflix really knew how popular it was going to become when they took it on, but it certainly became a huge hit for them.
I mean, it's absolutely huge. I mean, I've been wanting to watch it for years and just not got around to it. And then I thought this was a perfect excuse. And now you're saying, obviously, 6 seasons, I've got a lot of work to do, but I'm already halfway through the first season and I started today. it's been a good day, to be fair. It's been a good day.
Brannigan, what do you got?
I need a wingman tonight.
Blonde bar martini.
Mac? She's thinking.
Let's run BG Fantasy.
Ooh, yes.
Vodka soda, please.
Can we talk? I am so, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I just think that we're moving too fast.
Physically?
God, no. That thing that you do with your tongue is miraculous. You know what? Let's cancel BG. Take somebody else.
Don't leave.
You're gonna go after her?
Okay, I heard it all before. I know that really ain't for you.
Oh, good morning, princess.
Excuse me, sorry, guys. Mm-hmm. Could you point me to Kirk's office?
Was that a... I know.
Who is she again?
That's Nick Russell.
He's New York's most eligible bachelor.
He's a war reporter. And he saved an actual orphan from an actual burning building.
Was it burning?
Collapsing?
Sinking?
Maybe just like a bad building somewhere.
First of all, I watched your movie with my girlfriend, We loved it. And it feels like, I feel like we're not getting enough rom-coms, romantic comedies, things like that. It feels like we've had a real lull, and only recently seeing your movie, and there's been another one I saw the other week. It feels like there's a resurgence and it's coming back, and they're good, because I feel like there's been years of not so good romantic comedies and it's kind of killed the genre. So back on form, and I'm glad that it was a good watch. And this feels like a bit of a change of pace for you.
Yeah, it does. I'm glad you said what you did about the rom-com genre as well, because I have similar feelings about it.
Mm.
I loved rom-coms when I was growing up, and I felt like, similarly, there hasn't been any really good ones recently that I can think of. And it seemed like a genre that was like sort of just drifting in the breeze. And this the script for Players, when it came in, there was an air of nostalgia about it when I first read it, because it felt like an older rom-com. It had those sort of sensibilities about it. And I'm just glad it turned out the way it did, because it proves that, you know, if you make them well, then they sort of stand the test of time.
Mm.
And, you know, hopefully your audience is going to enjoy it like you and your missus did.
Mm. Well, I really did. And it's great that it's on Netflix as well, because sometimes, you know, like I go back to the films like Notting Hill, Bridget Jones's Diary, those kind of iconic Pretty Woman. And, you know, originally those films would have been in the cinema, but now it's so accessible and it's nice to be able to sit down and watch a decent film and be able to stream it like that. With your role, I don't want to give away too much to the audience, but he's kind of at first sight, you kind of think, oh, this guy's nice, this is great. And he slowly kind of changes into a little bit of a douche. It must have been an enjoyable role to play.
It was. And I think that was the sort of challenge for me. It was like, when I read it, there was obvious douchey qualities about him that came through. But I thought it was, the challenge was to try and let those sort of seep through slowly as you get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you know, we're, certainly people that work in the media as well, there's their sort of presentational side, and then there's the reality of their life. And I think he's very good at presenting what his life, you know, would and should be like, but it's quite a hollow existence when you get to know him.
Yeah, no, it's a great character, and really, preparing for this interview, I'll be very honest, I'd never seen Lucifer, which is obviously the thing that I'm sure a lot of people know you for, and now I'm really annoyed because I've just watched 5 hours straight. I'm stuck. And I've had things to do today, man, but I've just been watching that. So I just want to say I wasn't a fan until today, and now I'm a huge fan. And it feels like the role in the movie is kind of, it's a very different role, obviously, to Lucifer.
Yeah.
But there are definitely elements.
I think they've got similar size egos. It's just how they put them out to the world. And Lucifer is very open about his massive ego. Nick Russell has a massive ego, but he pretends that he doesn't, which is the worst kind of person.
Most embarrassing moments,
yeah. Oh, yeah, an embarrassing moment. It wasn't an audition, but it was when I was shooting the pilot of Rush, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in Vancouver, and it was in the middle of December. And I'd been on set all day. And I remember we'd been sort of talking about this character and setting up the character. And, you know, people had brought in mood boards and the costume designer was doing it. And I remember front and center of most of these mood boards was George Clooney. And they were like, he's like this, right? So I'm like, okay. So I'm in this hotel. I haven't seen a person in this hotel the entire time I've been staying there. But I was fully aware that on the third floor, on the roof, there was a hot tub. And I'd been at work all day, freezing my nuts off. And I got back to the hotel and I thought, I think I'm going to go and have a hot tub. I didn't have any swimming trunks or appropriate attire. So I put on an old pair of underpants and I got a robe from the room. And at this moment in time, I didn't realise that there was a his robe and a hers robe. And I grabbed the hers robe. Sort of humiliatingly, do you remember Neil Morrissey's robe in Men Behaving Badly? It was like, above his knees.
I'm going to insert a picture of that.
Yes. It was like that. But then I also had my man Uggs on. So I had man Uggs, like flesh, kneecaps, and then robe. And I thought, I'm just going to make a dash for it. So I go all huddled up to the elevator. I press the button. The doors open. And George Clooney is standing on his own in the elevator. And I'm like looking like this. And I just thought, oh my God, it's George Clooney. It wasn't meant to be like this. And I basically have to go into the elevator, and then it, for some reason, stops at every floor on the way down to where I'm going to. And I'm just lingering in this elevator, trying not to. And George Clooney starts doing that sort of whistling under his breath that people do when they don't want to talk to someone.
Awkwardness. Oh my God.
So humiliated.
That's perfect. So
I hope I get to meet him again one day properly and I can remind him of this story. But yeah.
He probably thought you were trying to seduce him in that outfit. That's wild.
Yes, exactly. Have a bit of this.
Well, thank you, Tom. This has been wicked. And all the best with Players, man. I mean, it's on Netflix. Everyone's going to watch it. So you haven't got any worries there. But yeah. No, thanks for taking the time.
And, thank you very much.
I appreciate it, man.
Nice.
All the best.
Take care.
Cheers, man.
Bye.
Thank you to our guest, Tom, and thank you to Personal PR. As always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.